10, 19, or should I say 19 minutes after 10. I'm Jenny Barnett. I'm sitting with Vanessa. We're talking about more support needed for patients after intensive care. I've got a very a sort of similar story. Back in 2010, my daughter, who then was 23, for some unknown reason, something happened and she had to have a very serious back operation. Really serious. And it was a six-hour operation which completely floored the family. When I went to the hospital to check out if everything was okay, I took Beth's godmother, one of my oldest, dearest friends, because I'd gone blind, deaf and dumb. I couldn't understand a word that was being said to me because of my anxiety. She had the op on Sunday and she was let out on the Wednesday because she had to learn to walk. I was terrified because as her mum, I didn't know what to do to help her walk again. And she was terrified, even though she'd been in since Sunday, because of the morphine and various other things, she already felt institutionalised. And she'd only been in there Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and she'd only been there 3 days. So if you, I know that our family was shocked, and we did all sorts of things like putting a mattress in the centre of the living room so she didn't have to go upstairs. But it was, I made endless telephone calls to all my cranks that I knew, from osteopaths to homeopaths to psychopaths, actually, all these people, to try and find out the best way forward. And it never occurred to me that I could have turned to somebody to ask what kind of aftercare should have been given to my 23-year-old. So if that, and it must happen to family after family after family. So if you are a family member who's suddenly been put in charge of somebody who's been intensive care or has come out of hospital after a serious op, what did you do? 0207 224 2000, text 81333 starting your message with the word London. Now I'm talking to Peter Gibb, former intensive care patient himself, co-founder of ICU Steps charity. Peter, I wish I'd known about you 3 years ago.
Oh, thank you, Jenny. I'm not sure what we could have done to help, but we do what we can.
Well, you see, the thing is that you having somebody like you and your charity on the end of the line that first of all says, don't panic, which is, I imagine, the first thing you say. It's also that you've been there and you've done it and you can help. What kind of calls do you get, Peter Gibb?
This is the thing. It's not so much. We're a very small charity, so we're not able to take calls directly. What we aim to do is we run support groups, drop-ins for ex-intensive care patients around the country. We've got about 12 of those going at the moment. Just so that, really, the sort of thing that you were alluding to, so that patients and their relatives can come and talk to people who can actually understand them because they've been through similar experiences.
May I ask, why did you find yourself in intensive care?
I had a mountain biking accident where I ended up with a brain hemorrhage, a broken neck, a broken back, and a punctured lung.
Wow.
But the surprising thing really is that there are very, very varied reasons that people can be admitted to intensive care, be it trauma, be it deterioration on the ward, or following major surgery. And the thing that never ceases to surprise me is that there are all these consequences that the degree of illness and the treatment itself leaves patients with physical, psychological, cognitive issues.
Yes, you see, this is interesting. Yeah, you see, 3/4 reported having moderate or severe pain a year after discharge. Now, you come across that, do you, Peter Gibb?
The surprising thing, pain is not something so much that we come across. It tends to be the psychological issue.
Well, yes, it's just under a half are significantly anxious or depressed. Now, what are the, I mean, can you kind of identify why?
There are lots of different reasons for it. Some of it's, as I say, to do with the degree of illness. Some of it's the treatment. There are many patients who suffer from anxiety. A lot of them related to the treatment itself, so the hallucinations, nightmares and flashbacks that they've experienced.
Oh, did you have that? Did you relive that dreadful moment on your mountain bike?
I actually have no memory of that, but my issue is actually almost the opposite. I went to bed one night, and when I woke up, 3 weeks were missing. And people were trying to convince me that these dreadful things had happened, but I had no pain because I was being pain managed. So it's very much like being in the film The Matrix.
Yeah.
People are trying to convince you of these bizarre stories. But if this was true, if this was normal, you'd have heard about it. It would be front page news that these sort of things happened.
How did that affect your family, your nearest and dearest?
It's awful. I mean, patients themselves can suffer from PTSD. So it's not just something that you get in the battlefield. But relatives can suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder as well. So really, although there is great sympathy from the nurses for the relatives while the patient's being treated, after, you know, when the patient is discharged from ICU to general ward and then to home, the onus really falls squarely on the relatives to try and coordinate the patient's care.
Well, let's take you, Peter Gibb. There you are with 3 weeks missing from your life. Did you have any physical trauma? I mean, did you lose any limbs? I mean, you said you broke your neck. Are you fully able now?
I suffered a spinal cord injury, but fortunately I am able to walk, which is something, again, that's quite surprising that you might find, is that rather than being upset and wondering why me, the patient population really has a new understanding of what's important in life. And given that's what happened, we feel really lucky to have survived.
That you have been given the gift of life after such
absolutely.
A
trauma.
So who was with you when you came out 3 weeks later and you were released from ICU? Who was there for you?
When I was discharged from ICU to the general ward, and this is actually something that is a major issue, it's that transition of care from the intensive care team, who are very highly skilled and very dedicated and know exactly what's going on and what's likely to follow the patient in the recovery and rehabilitation. You go down to a general ward, and because patients are often in ICU for multiple injuries, multiple reasons, you then get discharged to a general ward which is specialised in only one of them.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, the name's on the tin. It's a general ward.
Absolutely, absolutely. So when you get there, not only are you going down from one-to-one nursing to one-to-many nursing, but the skill levels of the people looking after you are also more general. And patients can often feel completely abandoned.
Did that happen to you? Did you feel abandoned?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. It was almost as if the patient's a rugby ball and you've been passed, you've been thrown from one department to another, as if it's no longer anyone's responsibility.
So who was fighting you? I mean, you're presumably lying in bed with a 3-week, 21-day memory loss. Who was next to your bed? Was it a partner, a parent, a friend?
It was my wife, thankfully.
And did she have to fight on your behalf?
She did, and my parents, to try and find out what was happening with the care, with plans for rehabilitation. And that's the shocking thing is, so much money is spent, I think it's somewhere in the region of £1,800 a day for a patient in intensive care, to get you to the point where you're going to survive and you're no longer likely to die. And yet, money spent on finishing the job and giving you rehabilitation back to the point of not just being a survivor, but being a fully functioning member of society again, is regarded as a luxury.
Really? So you set this charity up because?
Well, part of the reason I mentioned is you get bounced to a general ward, and you've been in sedation while you've been in intensive care for most of us. So you just start to come to terms with your surroundings, and then you get pushed somewhere else where no one seems to know what you've been through or what lies ahead for you. And not only that, none of the other patients around you have any appreciation of that either. So really, it's that isolation that just makes coping with what you're going through all that much harder.
And also the exhaustion, presumably, of having to keep repeating the story.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Because once, as bad as the general ward is, once you're out of hospital altogether, your only legitimate route back into the healthcare system is through your GP. And we've got no end of stories of patients going back to the GPs who didn't even know they'd been in intensive care and having to constantly repeat to them what they've been through, what the issues were, what the treatments were.
I can imagine the rage that and the resentment that gets thrown, and you talk about an invisibility. So how long ago was the charity started?
We started in 2005.
So really, I'm not very good at sums. I have to use my fingers. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So for 8 years, you have now got how many drop-in centres in how many cities?
We've got between 10 and 12 now on the go.
And where are you based in London?
We have a group that's trying to get going at the Royal London Hospital.
Right.
London has its own specific issues with transport and patient population that they're having to get over. But all around the country, whenever patients can get together and start realising that they're not the only person that's ever experienced this.
Yes, I hear that.
It makes such a relief.
Oh, Peter, please give us your website address immediately.
Certainly. It's icusteps.org.
I wish you well. I hope you're fully recovered, Peter Gibbon. If you're not, you will be soon. There you are, icusteps.org. Peter Gibb, former intensive care patient himself, co-founder of ICU Steps Charity. Now, if you have a story that's similar, I want to hear from you, 0207 224 2000.